Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back to Hey Kids Comics 2. That's what we're going for.
Okay.
That is what I think we're going for. Anyway, today we're covering The Prisoner, Shattered Visage, which I'm sure will appeal to a vast chunk of the audience.
Yeah.
And is in no way a minority interest.
Well, it's our show and we do what we want on our show.
We will. Before we did that, we were watching The Phantom Menace on big screen yesterday. It's been re-released.
We did, yes.
25th anniversary.
And it's not 25 years old. I failed.
I said this to you on the way out. I was the same age you are now when it came out originally.
Which is awful. Linear time sucks.
So you've got that thing, though, where I was watching it with you. But when I watched it originally, I was you. I was the same age you were. It's all wibbly, wobbly.
The master becomes the apprentice. Yes. The apprentice.
Yeah. 25 years later, did it still resonate, seeing as you loved?
I loved the fact. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing it. I love Jar Jar. I love the film. It's great fun. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing it on the big screen as well. I just love that film. I've got nothing bad to say about it. It's, you know, it's great.
Okay.
And it perfectly... It's a film that's very much of its time.
Mm.
Like, you know, I've been very much enjoying seeing pictures of Toys R Us in 99 and all the merchandise that I used to have.
Yeah, you had everything.
It's just there's something about it where, I don't know, if you get that warm and fuzzy feeling from watching the first three Star Wars films, that's how I was watching The Phantom Menace. Like, it was joy. For me, seeing Phantom Menace on the big screen was just joy.
But even that, we both got a little bit giddy about seeing the Star Wars on the big screen.
Yeah.
Even though I, honestly, and you completely disagree with this, I think it's the worst of the six.
Yeah.
I think it's easily the worst of the six.
But I don't even think it's the worst of the three.
You don't think it's the worst prequel, do you?
The Attack of the Clones is my favourite, simply because it's the only one that I remember watching at the cinema.
Right.
So there is that caveat that, yes, it's not very good, but I like it.
Right.
And it's mostly nostalgia. Whereas I think that The Phantom Menace is the stronger. I think it might be the stronger of the three of them. I just think that Revenge of the Sith is more mature. So you tend to think that that one's the stronger simply because it's more mature.
Right.
But I think that Phantom Menace is stronger than it gets credit for.
Okay. Well, I think it's still got all the same problems that it's ever had.
Well, it's not going to change. No.
I think in 25 years with hindsight, I don't think the Jar Jar effects are great.
No.
But some of the other CG still holds up really well. I think it's now a much more obvious where Ewan McGregor was called back for reshoots.
Right.
Because on the big screen, his herpes really sticked out, didn't it? Because I kept going, there you go, reshoot.
Yeah, yeah.
And you and I discussed this when we came out of the cinema. It's infuriating in its storytelling, in that it's all there. Like, it's clear from what's going on, if you're paying attention, that Obi-Wan gives himself to hate and anger to defeat Darth Maul, so he's not ready for the trials.
Yeah.
Therefore, he's not ready to take ownership of Anakin.
Mm.
And as you pointed out, it's clear Qui-Gon realizes he has to die for Anakin to be taken into the bosom of the Jedi.
Yeah.
But I don't think George ever connects those dots for you. Now, there's subtlety in storytelling, which we're all for, but I also think there has to be clarity in storytelling.
Right.
And it feels to me like he wants to let Obi-Wan off the hook slightly for what happens.
Well, because I suppose the thing is, if say even Return of the Jedi, where you've got Luke going into the dark side, that's never really like spelt out.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be in Return of the Jedi. Because you've got that great visual scene of him stood under the stairs while Vader says, "So you have a twin sister,"
and
he's half light, heart. And at that point, he could go either way.
The music swelling.
And then Vader says, "If you will not turn to the dark side, then perhaps she will." And that's what brings him back.
And I suppose as well, that is the end. That's like the payoff and the climax, whereas this is essentially the setup.
But I never think he connects that as well as he could. Like, maybe there should have been a discussion between Yoda and Mace Windu at some point in the third film.
Yeah.
That young Anakin still has a lot of anger in him. Obi-Wan still had a lot of anger in him because of the death of Qui-Gon. Maybe we shouldn't have given him to Obi-Wan.
Well,
because Yoda doesn't want to.
Yeah.
That was something I only twigged on this viewing. Yoda is against Anakin being given to Obi-Wan. He's not yeah. against him being brought into the Order, but he doesn't think Obi-Wan's ready, but the Council have overruled him.
Mm.
And again, that's another wonderful piece of subtle storytelling that George never really connects the dots on.
Yeah.
But it is, but it's all there. So it is all there.
In that case then, especially knowing where we get to in Revenge of the Sith, how much of it would have been better if there was less emphasis on the Clone Wars and the mm. setup of that and Attack of the Clones, and it was more the dynamic between them.
Yeah, the more the dynamic between Obi-Wan. And the problem I have as well with Attack of the Clones is it splits Obi-Wan and Anakin off for a vast chunk of its running time.
Yeah.
Whereas that really should have been where you saw the schism start in their relationship.
Mm.
Because even up to the set piece at the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, Anakin and Obi-Wan are still best mates. They've had their differences. They'll yeah. fall out and bicker occasionally. But they're still, when he leaves him and says, you go off and play, oh, I'm not brave enough for politics.
Yeah.
He goes off and does whatever he's doing. There's not really been a schism between them.
It's that thing as well where one of the good things about Star Wars and its strengths is the stuff going on in between the films.
There's an entire 7-season Clone Wars TV show, though.
But the problem with that is in between the films, you've got an entire relationship that you haven't really seen.
Hmm. And I think it's fine that he tainted it in broad strokes, but I really do think everyone slags off 7, 8, and 9 for not having a through line. It's a valid criticism. But I don't know that he has that through line planned in 1, 2, and 3.
I think he has a beginning and an end. He just doesn't have a middle.
And he doesn't really... It should have been what the Fall Guy was. That romance,
which you also went watching,
which I also went watching, that romance between Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling runs through the film
right.
whilst all the action set pieces are happening. That should have been all three of the prequel movies,
or it should have kept them together enough so it is a brothers in arms kind of
yeah,
thing.
And not having Padme and Anakin fall in love in the first film puts you on the back foot, because then he's got to establish, he's only got two films then to establish all that,
yeah,
whereas he could have had three. If he'd structured it like Superman, and I said this back on Old Hey Kids,
right.
If he'd structured it like Superman and the Anakin bits, he's only like the first 45, 50 minutes.
Mm.
And then at the 45, 50 minute mark, Hayden Christian comes in and takes over.
Right.
So Hayden Christensen is in all three of them. Or Jared Padalecki, which is what I would have preferred.
Right. Okay.
But I don't know that Jared Padalecki was a thing in 1999, was he? Was he in Gilmore Girls at that point? I don't know.
In 99?
Anyway. Yeah, was it?
No, Gilmore Girls was in 99.
What was it now?
2001, surely.
Was it? Okay,
I don't know.
Whatever. Either way, Hayden Christensen should have been brought in Phantom Menace, and the relationship between him and Padme should have been started there.
Yeah.
Because it comes across in Phantom Menace that she just thinks he's this cute kid.
Yes.
And the age gap between them, because Jake Lloyd was only 9.
Yeah.
But Natalie Portman was about, what, 18?
15, 16. She was doing her GCSEs.
Was she?
Yeah.
So she was 15, she 16 years old.
She couldn't attend the premiere because she was doing her GCSEs.
And then in the two sequels, she was off at university.
Yeah.
So, all right. So the age gap between them isn't that much, but it's enough on screen.
Yeah.
Because Natalie Portman looks like a semi-mature teenager.
You do kind of get that in the second one, where she is not completely interested and she spends half of the film going, how do I put down this incredibly horny teenage boy?
Do you know what? There's a brilliant bit in the book that should have been in the film.
Right.
I think I've told you this before.
Yeah.
When they go back to her little home city and Anakin meets her parents and her sisters.
Right.
She has a scene in the book where she talks to her sister about it, and her sister's like, are you two, you know? And Padme's all like, no, it's nothing like that. She said, don't lie to me. And she goes through this big long monologue about how her entire life has been structured and ordered, not yeah. just from the job that she does, but the boys that she's been allowed to date.
Right.
And Anakin is dangerous.
He's the bad boy.
Yeah. Anakin is everything she's never been allowed to be exposed to.
Hmm.
And that's what she finds irresistible about him.
Right.
And they should have, A, left that in the film,
yeah.
and B, focused on that more.
Because it gives more kind of weight to the argument that in Revenge of the Sith, she definitely has the hots for Obi-Wan.
Well, why wouldn't you?
Well, but surely that gives it more, and especially the payoff that Anakin thinks that there's something going on if there was actually something going on.
Yeah.
Because she was coerced into a relationship she didn't necessarily want, when actually she fancied the more grounded, yeah, more charismatic older brother.
That's what I think. Phantom Menace as well, should have been young Obi-Wan who went into town with Padme. And Anakin, and the relationship between the three of them started there.
But then you don't get Big Liam.
But you don't get Big Liam, and everyone needs Big Liam.
And Big Liam does, it's as stiff as he is, Big Liam does have some good bits on Tatooine.
He does have some good bits. And on screen, you can see some more subtleties to his performance on the big screen. That when Watto doesn't respond to his Jedi mind trick, his face actually goes, oh, for f***. You can actually see it in his face.
Yes.
And like you said, the bit at the end where Maul's pacing around like a panther and Obi-Wan's angry and he can't be in there joining the fight. Big Liam just centres himself.
Why did he not use the super fast force run that they use only once at the beginning of the film? That would have come in quite handy.
The big super jumps. You do. Never do that again, do they?
No.
And again, I always thought that should have been something that kind of took it out of him. When he does his super jump, there should be a moment where he goes,
it's got to recharge
into the force and leap, and that takes a little bit out of them because it's a big expenditure of force usage. But these are all armchair quarterbacking. If I could retell the prequels, I would have that be more of a through line. I would have it be Padme does have a bit of a crush on Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan can never act upon that impulse, so kind of just ignores it.
Yeah.
Anakin has a crush on Padme. Padme settles for Anakin but still loves Obi-Wan. And that's what sends Anakin over to the dark side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to say it's easy to kind of change these things in hindsight, but the prequels literally were changing things in hindsight, so...
And in the prequels make it so everything that Obi-Wan tells him in Star Wars is a crock of shit.
Yeah.
But that is what it is now, isn't it? All you can do now is dance around those raindrops and try and make it all fair.
Yeah.
But I still maintain the prequels has better characters and better character backstories and arcs and explorations of those characters than either the original trilogy or the sequels.
Yeah, and there's a lot of little things, like we were saying yesterday as well, like you kind of see the like ruins in Naboo or the kind of statues outside the Jedi Temple, and you're thinking, well, that's really interesting.
What's all this backstory?
I wonder what's that? What's this going on?
Yeah.
The problem is we've ultimately ended up now with Star Wars that will tell you the backstory behind everything, but there's so much going on. It's so rich, and I think whether this is a lot of because of Doug Chiang and a lot of his concept art and that, and how that has kind of come in, but even the fashion and that kind of thing, it's just so rich, and seeing that on the cinema screen as well. Like, The Phantom Menace, I maintain, is still one of the more visually rich and colourful and vibrant films.
Yeah, I do.
There's so much going on, and that holds up. Star Wars has always had a visual identity, but this, I think Phantom Menace has like an identity in and of itself. It's just so vibrant, and that's like, you know, that you know, that is kind of Star Wars. Like, you want those bright colors, you want that kind of, it's just, yeah, it's just nice.
It's what I think. It's one of them, if you don't like it, you're not going to like it seeing it again on the big screen. You may be able to appreciate the aesthetics a bit more. Like you said, there are frames that are frame worthy.
Yeah.
In that film that could be paintings or whatever. But there are still shortcomings in the storytelling that I don't know if it's because George knew the story and therefore felt we knew it.
Right.
And therefore didn't feel the need to fill those blanks in, or it's because he didn't have somebody like Gloria Katz or Willard Hook doing a story pass for him or whatever and saying, you need to make this clearer for the audience.
He was let loose a little more than he should have been.
And certainly there are elements where I don't think it's just as loosey-goosey as the original trilogy in terms of tying up its stories. Like, he'll suddenly get an idea and throw it in there, even if it contradicts his earlier ideas.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you liked it, then you're probably going to like it now. If you didn't, I enjoyed it. I've never hated on it as like other people have. And you know that. You grew up with those films, and I'd sit and watch them with you. And there are bits of it that are still brilliant. And certainly the pod racing scene is fantastic on the big screen.
I will die on the hill that Jake Lloyd is great in it.
Jake Lloyd is not the problem.
Like, just this genuinely still gut emotional gut punches when he realizes his mum's not coming with, and when he can't do it and he runs back and she has to say,
see, I didn't, that's it as well. I didn't get, so he'll go out on a limb to rescue Jar Jar from whatever his punishment's going to be. Mesa going to be torture. But when he gets to Tatooine, suddenly he's all like, no, I can't rescue slaves. Well, why not? If you got the lightsaber under Watto's chin and said, I'm taking the mum as well.
Right.
But he can't do that because that's not the story.
Well, that's why, I think that's why, and I don't think I noticed this before, whether I'm paying attention or not, but there's a line of dialogue that goes, there's the chip inside us that will blow us up if we try to leave.
Mm.
So I guess, you know, even if you could threaten, they don't, you know, it's just one of those things, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to kind of go with it. So it was nice to see it on the big screen again. And I said to you, it's a real shame it's not doing what they did with the special editions, that Attack of the Clones is next week and Revenge of the Sith is the week after.
Got to wait for the 25th anniversary.
I know, got to wait another 3 years. Yeah. It's like it being in 1999 again. Because I like Attack of the Clones.
Oh, I love it.
And I've always liked Attack of the Clones. And I like, there's a, even contradicting what I just said, I kind of like the Obi-Wan Solo stuff, even though I kind of wish they hadn't split the two of them up.
But I think it's in the era now where everything is kind of a standalone.
Mm.
Obi-Wan and Dexter Jet would be a really solid 6-episode.
Obi-Wan, the Obi-Wan series, why did he not go back and see Dexter?
Yeah.
That would have been cool. Anyway, we're not a Star Wars podcast, although you wouldn't know it from the amount of times we've covered Star Wars on the show. So let's have a look. We've got a couple of emails, so we'll blitz through one. Rob McCarthy's got one. Handy, Highlander 2 is really bad. I don't remember saying it wasn't. I don't think an alternate parallel universe exists where I have defended Highlander 2, because I think I've said to you, when you're talking about franchises where the first one's really locked in Stone Cold 5-star classic, the rest are just kind of there.
Yeah.
Highlander 1 is the locked on Stone Cold classic, but the series is better.
Okay.
I've never defended Highlander 2, have I? Because it's utter.
I haven't seen Highlander
Bobbins.
2.
Well, that's fair.
Maybe I should, and maybe I will come back and say, actually.
No, you won't. It's utterly dreadful. Everybody thinks machine guns on wheelchairs are a good idea. It's not, trust me. See, I want to know if he has machine guns on his wheelchair.
Yeah.
Because my thing of that is, you open fire, right, and wouldn't it just push backwards?
Yeah.
Two, I would argue Doom Patrol was never a flop. It had a bunch of series that last a bit, like Hawkman or Doctor Strange. See, I think it's got a cult following, but I don't think that cult following has ever translated to healthy sales, apart from its first iteration that ran for, what did we say, 104 issues?
Something like that, yeah.
The Chief was sketchy even in the old days. He owned a beer stain in the days when holding a beer bottle. A beer stain? What's a beer stain? I don't know what that is. You'd have to tell us what that is, Rob. And how you should, Doctor Strange was a wreck. I don't really like the Chief being a bad dude, but I get he's made lots of moral compromises.
Oh, it's a stein.
Oh, right. Sorry, I read it wrong. That's my... Sorry, I apologise. To get help taking a pee at the airport, we all have it. Keep up the great work. We will try to keep up that great work, Rob. I don't know if other people need to tell us. Oh, there's a PS. Doom Patrol was very Marvel. Yeah, we said that, didn't we?
Mm.
It was very Marvel. Robot Man is the thing. Yeah, I suppose so. But there's enough subtlety in character. The Robot Man doesn't seem to be as angsty as the thing.
Mm.
But by the same token, he's not as funny.
Yeah.
So Ben Grimm's got that going for him. Negative Man is an entire superhero based on a Stan Lee plot. My heart rate is up. I'm reverting to Banner. Yeah, well, like, this goes into the Doom Patrol being Marvel, doesn't it? Mm. It was very much a Marvel concept. I don't know about crossovers, but I ain't reading a Doom Patrol that starts with Batman. Well, you're missing out, because that was a very, very, very good Doom Patrol, in my humble opinion. Anyway, before we read another email, we'll start going into what we're going into today, which is The Prisoner, Shattered Visage, which is a 4-issue sequel to The Prisoner, the 1967 television series starring Patrick McGoohan as Number 6, a former secret agent kidnapped and imprisoned in The Village. The Prisoner was both baffling and engrossing in equal measure. I loved it. Others didn't. Did I show you The Prisoner?
Oh, yeah, I've seen The Prisoner plenty of times. I don't think I've ever rewatched it in full, but I've seen plenty of when it used to be on ITV quite a bit as well.
Mm.
So I've seen it in full once, and then other than that, just the odd episodes here and there. So I've seen Arrival, and I've seen the last episode plenty of times. Then the odd one, isn't there the one where he's trapped in that kind of western town as well? So I've seen plenty of it.
Yeah. Okay. So it's going to be interesting to see what you thought of this. The Prisoner. Came back and went away and came back, and they do novels and stuff every now and again. We don't talk about the reboot. The reboot with Jim Caviezel and Ian McKellen.
Ian McKellen, it was bizarre that McKellen agreed to do that.
I think I lasted 10 minutes and went, nope.
Was it that era when America was literally adapting British shows? Like, literally.
Like Life on Mars.
So when they did Life on Mars, he was literally living on Mars, or any way to live on Mars.
Yeah, that wasn't very good either. Mm. But anyway, the most interesting announcement regarding the prisoner, to me anyway, came in 1988 when DC Comics announced a fully authorized sequel to the show to be published as four square-bound bookshelf editions, which showed DC's commitment to the series in that they were treating it as a more mature book, aimed at an older audience by using the same format as series such as Frank Miller's Dark Knight, Neil Gaiman's Books of Magic. There was a couple of others of them. Do you remember any of them?
The prestige format
was. Yeah. Miss Kid Eternity, was that a prestige format thing?
Could have been.
They did a lot of them bookshelf editions, they were called, weren't they, at the time. This was co-written by Dean Motta and Mark Asquith, with art by Dean Motta. The prisoner, Shattered Visage, had to be fully vetted by ITC and Patrick McGoohan. So you can imagine that went well. And another actor, Leo McKern, who appears as number two in this series. McGoohan, notoriously prickly, demanded he be sent every issue beforehand to sign off. And due to the purchase of the likeness rights, both McGoohan and McKern had an option to view the art. McGoohan apparently signed off each issue without comment, with ITC telling Motta that he didn't hate it.
Which is high praise.
Oh, totally. From McGoohan. McKern apparently enjoyed being a comic book villain and told Motta so in a note to the artist.
Especially because he didn't have to put any effort in, I think he said.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I have the original DC Comics trade from 1990, which Michael Bailey sent me.
Nice.
And it's in lovely condition there, isn't it? The original printing of the four-issue trade paperback.
So why did DC do it? Because it's inherently a very British show, despite its connections to McGoohan, it's still inherently British.
It had a reasonably large cult following, which I know seems like a contradiction,
right?
In America, because I think I first remember reading about the prisoner in Starlog magazine, of all places.
Okay,
and or had I already seen it at that? Channel 4 reran it when Channel 4 started. In about 1984-ish. Mm. I'd have to look up the date. That's where I first saw it.
Right.
But I seem to be vaguely aware of it before then.
Mm.
And I can't remember if it's because, like, there was a book called Fantastic Television.
Right.
Which went through, like, Star Trek and Doctor Who and all the other stuff of that era. And Starlog would cover The Prisoner quite a lot.
Yeah.
And they actually had an episode guide for it.
Because it was weirdly huge. Like, considering it's more or less obscure culty now, still a lot of people know. I mean, it was on The Simpsons,
yes,
which is, you know, a benchmark for any kind of degree of success.
Yeah, if you've been mocked on The Simpsons,
it's that kind of thing where it's a weirdly a big thing that isn't a big thing.
Yeah, I think it's tailed off a little bit now. Because obviously it's not been rerun on network television in some considerable time.
Yeah.
But I remember there were TV adverts,
right,
that mocked or homaged The Prisoner. Like, I can't remember what the model car was, being chased by Rover around Port Merion.
And Rover's knocked about in a few different things.
Yeah, and there was The Groovy Fellas, which was Jules Holland's TV show.
Okay.
After The Tube that he did at night
with
Roland Riveron, who was a drummer in his band. Okay. And in one episode of that, they went to Port Merion dressed as the characters.
Right.
It was originally called The Groovy but they couldn't call it that for obvious reasons. But I think, this could be a bit of TV history that I'm getting wrong. I'm sure Holland called them that on The Tube and got banned from The Tube for a couple of episodes.
Okay.
For saying it.
Yeah.
In the same way that Sean Ryder on TFI Friday caused them to have to film TFI Friday on a delay.
Right, okay.
Instead of being live. Because he would not swear.
Right.
So The Groovy Fellas was quite fun.
So this was still very much embedded into the zeitgeist.
Yeah. So in 1987, 88, when this came out, it'll have been celebrating its 20th anniversary, won't it?
Yeah, right.
So it will have been quite big at that point. You've got the most recent Titan Books reprint, which I bought you for £1.99 for Christmas.
Yeah, which I think it's different. It's not called The Prisoner Shattered Visage. It's just called The Prisoner.
Right.
The cover edits out the figures in the sky.
Yeah, it's just the penny farthing on the beach, isn't it?
Glossy paper. I think it's got a new introduction.
Mine isn't glossy paper. Why is it paper? It's lovely.
It's just matte, yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely reproduction there.
So that colouring looks a little different. They wouldn't have edited it, but I didn't bring mine because I didn't see the point. We've got a copy here.
But it's a shame that we didn't do a comparison
And
beforehand.
yeah, I
But
think
yeah, mine has absolutely no back matter or introductions or anything at all.
mine's got an intro by number two's daughter who skirts around. It reads like she is being asked to do this as a favor, and she is less than favorable about it,
Well, the prisoner caused her dad to have a heart attack.
which she also mentions in it as well.
So,
And it has a epilogue by the guy who wrote it, essentially explaining how it happened, and then he got a lot of people to help him with research, and one person was so good at his research and helpful that he essentially got a co-writing credit because of it. And yeah, it just has some sketches and the original covers in the back.
So mine doesn't have any of that, but it's a lovely package. It's a lovely trade. Really nicely, handsomely done. Anyway, shall we give you a brief synopsis? I
Dun
say
dun
brief.
dun.
Set 20 years after the series finale, so 1987, female British Secret Service agent Alice Drake has recently resigned following certain missions that went south. Ditching her husband, Thomas, a fellow agent and head of a small section, and dumping her daughter, Megan, in boarding school, Alice has decided that as a competent sailor, she will take a round-the-world journey on a modern computerized boat that will handle all her navigation for her. The Leo McKern version of Number Two was convicted under the Official Secrets Act and sentenced to 20 years imprisonment shortly to end, but has written a best-selling book about the village entitled The Village Idiot. The book has been seriously redacted and rewritten by Thomas until people believe it to be fiction. The village has been evacuated and Number Six has disappeared, whereabouts unknown. However, food and power are still being supplied to the mysterious location. Alice sets out on her voyage, unaware that her shipboard computer has been tampered with by Thomas and his unofficial partner, American agent Lee West. Lee is exceptionally shady, but experienced MI5 operative. Thomas Drake doesn't seem to spot that he's very shady. Alice has been warned of severe weather, but finds she can't really do anything about it and is shipwrecked on a familiar beach. That of the village. The village has seen better days, and in the green dome, formerly Number Two's chambers, sat in the bubble chair, she finds its only occupant, the former Number Six, older and heavily bearded. Apparently, when the village was evacuated, Six chose to stay. Old Number Six gives Alice the title of New Number Six and shows her around. Old Number Two arrives on the island by helicopter, flown by an aged version of the butler. Apparently, DC didn't get the likeness rights to actor Angelo Muscat, as we only see him in shadow. He hunts out our Number Six for a confrontation which becomes a brawl. Former Number Six makes a pretty poor showing of it, given how competent a fighter he was in the series. Meanwhile, in London, Whitehall is concerned about the village and the information it holds, which seemed a bit odd given they seem to know all about where the village is and could have raided it at any time in the last 20 years, but we'll go with it. Thomas is director of operations, Ross, sends in a UN force along with Thomas and Lee to invade the village, where they uncover the secret, a nuclear warhead rocket. Former Number Two sets it off. Thomas and former Number Two are killed when it goes off, destroying the village. Our Number Six and Alice Drake return to London. How? No idea. She tries to get more information out of him, but he continues being as obtuse as ever. I don't know if that synopsis does it justice.
It's a very, even reading this, it's a very weird one. It's weirdly abstract. It tells you a lot whilst also not
Telling
telling
you
you a lot.
anything. So it's very prisoner in that regard. Which, so I thought, quite interesting. This wasn't numbered issues 1, 2, 3, and 4. It was actually volumed A, B, C, and D, which fits in with an episode of the show called A, B, and C. Volume one was called Arrival, A Rival. See what they did there? B was by hook or by crook, C was confrontation, and D was departure. And it opens with a communicator, Mrs. Butterworth, MI5, discussing the village, Number Six, and mostly, in addition to some art of somebody reading the computer and sipping coffee, there are actually stills, photograph stills, of Patrick McGoohan as Number Six and of the village.
Well, this is exclusive to this trade.
Oh, is it? Right.
And I quite like what they do with the, I mean, I like what they do with the photos throughout it. They're still edited, even if it's changing the color. There's a nice contrast to them and saturation to them. And it kind of works as well, because considering I haven't watched it in full for a while, this is a nice little catch-up. Although I did hear that apparently this caused some criticism as it retconned the last episode as being a
Yeah,
drug trip.
it does. It does kind of disavow Fallout to kind of, but I don't know that it disavows it.
Because I think Fallout is
batshit crazy anyway.
yeah, and but it's intentionally open.
Yes, it's
Well,
intentionally open because Patrick McGoohan had no idea what he was doing.
yeah, and
So.
so I didn't really feel like it kind of retconned anything. You can read into it either way that you want.
Mrs. Butterworth mentioned in this opening. Did you remember her?
Yeah, she was one of the number twos.
She was one of the number
Because she's
twos, wasn't
later on as well, they go
she?
to visit her.
Yeah, she was the number two in Many Happy Returns. And she's seen in that episode as owning Six's house
Right.
and Six's car. So when Thomas, who's driving Six's Lotus in this, says Mrs. Butterworth gave it to me, that seems to imply she did actually take possession of Six's Lotus.
Right.
I don't know why. It seemed very coincidental that Alice lived in number six's apartment, though.
Because I did notice that's his car that he's driving.
Yeah, he's driving the Lotus. The lead character, speaking of Alice, is Alice Drake, which is a tip to the persistent rumour that number six was John Drake,
From,
McGoohan's character in
yeah.
Danger Man. Yeah, it's never explicitly stated whether she is a relation to John Drake, because it can't be, because Danger Man was owned by a completely separate people.
Yes.
And if he'd acknowledged that six was John Drake, he would have had to pay those people.
Yeah.
But so, which is why he never did. The closest McGoohan came to ever acknowledge anything was, well, they look alike.
Right, okay.
That's the most of what he said. I do like the brevity of storytelling here and how we learn all the backstory. She walked past a magazine rack with a sailing magazine, which sets up her round the world trip because it's her on the cover as she's looking at her own magazine. And they accomplish that in a couple of panels. And that's all set up really well, isn't it?
I really like the pacing of this. It lets it breathe, and I think it's because of it's the format. Again, I read another critique saying 50 of its 180 pages are dialogueless,
But it's a comic.
and it allows the narrative to breathe. This is still telling a story, and you pick up on she's being followed,
Yep.
and it does this really good job. And straight off the bat, like not only the storytelling, but the coloring's really nice, and there's a really there's a lot of use of photos, but none of it comes across as lazy or anything. It's
No,
really
no, no.
interesting, and the colors add to that. The back matter for mine, it has the original pages for some of them, and you
Right.
can see where he's pasted on the photo, but then continued drawing to expand it.
Yeah.
So he's expanding the photos by drawing what
Right.
isn't captured in the frame. And it's really interesting, and kind of just I think automatically this kind of set the tone for me. This reads like it looks like a Vertigo comic.
Well, I think it slightly predates Vertigo, but it would have been a Vertigo book,
Yeah,
wouldn't it?
it has the visual
Yeah.
identity, and
I love the art.
it kind of reads like a British invasion Vertigo. This is the art style of it is just very kind of it evokes that Britishness.
Yeah, I love the art. I think the sketchiness of it, like you said, doesn't make you think it's unfinished or not been paid attention to. It actually adds to it. And again, the use of TV stills to accompany the action is really clever because it makes it follow the look of the series.
Yeah.
Now, certainly the shot of him driving the Lotus into the car park and walking through,
Yeah.
that's stills, isn't it?
Yeah.
So is that what you were on about? You sketched out the
No,
sides.
there's quite, and I think you went past when she's walking past Parliament or something, or this
Oh, yeah.
building here, that's an actual building.
Yes, it is.
But what he would have done is, let's say, for instance, it's not this panel that's in the back, so I'm only guessing, but the building will end where it goes from brown to blue. But what he'll then do is he'll draw over it, so this he'll just be drawing to extend the photo.
Right. It mentions Terry Waite, the real story, which sets it at a very specific time.
There's a lot of that, because there's a lot of mentions of Thatcherism and that kind of
Yeah.
thing, and I liked that. It sets it in a very specific time that because of the characters, it has to exist in this time,
Yes.
but it grounds it, I think, to have that kind of political turmoil and unrest in the background that isn't there. It's more or less kind of set dressing,
Yeah.
but it gives it a bit more weight.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's not specifically a political story, but the background and you're dealing with MI5 and Secret Service and secret locations and spies and being followed.
Yeah.
So it is a political
Yeah.
story in that way. I like that she bought a copy of Alice in Wonderland and The Secret Garden. Because if you read the opening pages, Alice in Wonderland could be described as Alice's journey to the village.
Yeah.
So isn't there's a literary parallel.
Isn't she buying them to
She's
give to
buying
her
them
daughter?
For her daughter, yeah. And The Secret Garden is about a neglected 10-year-old girl.
Right.
Essentially, that's what she's doing to her daughter, isn't it? Given that Alice and Thomas pretty much abandoned their daughter, seemed like a bit of an on-the-nose book to be given to her.
Yeah.
But, you know.
There's quite a lot here with... I think one of my initial kind of reluctances was the prisoner was so very clearly... It didn't explain anything.
No.
Because essentially, it was just throwing shit at the wall and let's see if it sticks.
Very definitely.
And so initially, I was a little reluctant because I was like, well, I don't want to see behind the scenes. I don't want to see who's in charge. But it does that thing. It reminded me a lot of The Invisibles.
Mm.
One of the genuinely scary things about The Invisibles is that it drops all these things but doesn't tell you who's behind them. Doesn't tell you who's pulling the strings.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's these things going on here is, yes, we are peeking behind the curtain. We are seeing more than we probably would like to, but we're also being shown there's another curtain. We're also being implied that there's another curtain behind that. And it adds these kind of layers that start getting more and more unnerving. Well, we're being watched by these people,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know anything about that. So they must be someone else has told them to do it, but who's telling them to do it? And suddenly you start feeling like more and more you are very small and insignificant, and there are eyes looking at you and there's eyes looking at them, and it's unnerving.
Yeah, and it's very well, it's less The Prisoner this and more, I don't know if you'd ever seen Edge of Darkness.
No.
Which was an 80s TV spy thing with Bob Peck in it.
Right.
And Wade from the Pierce Brosnan James Bond films.
Okay.
I forget his name. But it's also got a lot of John Le Carré to it, do you not think?
Oh, the novelist.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, just this week, me and your mum have watched Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yeah.
By pure coincidence. And another film with Ewan McGregor and Skarsgård in it, one of the Skarsgårds.
Mm.
And Skarsgård is a Russian mafia guy defecting to Britain.
Right.
And that's a John Le Carré script as well. And both of them have that similar feel of real people being involved in shady spy stuff.
Yeah, because you're not even in the village until the end of the last... And are these double-length issues as well?
Yeah, they're 48-page issues.
But the characters are weirdly captivating as well. There's not a lot going on with them, but they pull you in and they are quite interesting.
Well, I read this four times.
Right, okay.
I read it, and then I digested it, and then I read it and did the synopsis. And then I read it again to do the notes.
Yeah.
And then I had to read the fourth issue again because I wasn't quite sure what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
But not in a bad way.
Yeah.
It just requires that you are actually paying attention to it.
And there is lots of bits like going on. You'll see people doing something in the background, but it won't say anything.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's stuff like... I don't know whether to go so far to say it undoes Fallout, but it implies that the story that they've been told about Fallout was heavily influenced by the use of hallucinogens.
Yeah.
But the fact that there is a nuclear rocket under the village, which is established in Fallout, implies that Fallout must have happened, if not necessarily as we saw it, in some way. Because... at the end of Fallout, Leo McKern's number two is seen to be quite happy and walking back to his job. But in this, he's been arrested, but he's still written a book about the village. A couple of minor notes. Thomas and Alice are both terrible parents.
Yeah.
They're passing the kid off between each other and then just throw her in boarding school.
Mm.
And when Alice is actually says, what about her?
Yeah.
When Thomas asks, what about Megan? Before she casts off, like she doesn't really give a shit about her daughter.
Mm.
And Thomas is ignoring that he could have her.
Yeah.
Rather than shipping her off to boarding school.
Well, it was quite interesting as well. She outright states she wanted to get away to get her freedom. So is that... I read that as very much lashing out against. She's got a job that dictates who she is, where she can go. She's dictated as well because of...
being a wife and mother.
Being a wife. And then also like... So yeah, like I totally bought into like she just wants to... like, just get rid of everything, exercise everything.
And get away for a
which,
bit.
Which, again, gives you that kind of, you know, the themes of she's going to the island. She's become this prisoner. She has become a prisoner within her own life.
Yeah. which a lot of people can relate to. Lee, of all people, is American CIA, isn't he? Or established as being CIA, we should say. Doesn't necessarily turn out that way. I thought he had a massive set of balls on him to slag off great pub grub in favour of McDonald's. That well-known bastion of great cuisine.
Well, that's his character, isn't it? He kind of shits on everything inherently British. There's the argument about baseball and cricket. It's kind of everything he does, everything's better in the States.
Yeah. But he ends up being a complete cipher, doesn't he? We never find out anything about him.
He works for the higher-ups in the organisation, doesn't he?
The Archangels.
Yeah, yeah.
Which made me think of Erwolf.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it always does. Alice launches from Port Muscat, obviously a reference to Angelo Muscat, who played the butler. This scene was brilliant, where Lee is pretending to be working for the BBC.
Yeah.
Shakes hands with Thomas. In issue 3, this comes back to bite them on the arse.
Yeah.
And it's just played off as a decent, oh, I remember you from a pub thing somewhere.
Yeah.
That's decent. But, right, this is the bit I had to reread it a couple of times for.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas tries to take a floppy disk earlier on from Alice's apartment.
Mm.
It's apparently, it's never spelled out, but apparently that's the disk that has all of her coordinates and stuff on for the boat.
Yeah.
Because
the
boat is fully computerized.
Yeah.
Which will have been a modern big thing in 1980.
They also specifically mentioned that they wanted her to land in the village.
Well, that was my question, and that's why I had a look. Lee then takes that disc from her vessel, the Vorpal Blade. Why did they change the navigational computer? Did they want her to sail by the village?
Yes.
But not crash at the village?
That's what they say.
And right.
It's the storm that crashes her on there.
Yes. So after she crashes, Lee tells Thomas, the High Eye tells me your wife arrived. So Lee didn't want her to crash there, but did other people want her to?
Right, okay, yeah.
I was a little bit confused about that. Is Lee implying here that he's made her crash at the village, whereas Thomas wanted to just sail right by?
And that also kind of lends itself to the ultimate plot twist that he is also operating on someone else's orders.
Who is High Eye?
Yeah.
Who is that? What is that person?
Mm.
Is he British, American, something else completely?
Yeah.
Because in the spy game, it seems that often nationalities don't play into it. If you're friends with somebody, they'll share their information with you.
Right.
But they won't share all of it.
Yeah.
And that's how it all seems to, and it doesn't seem to be that different today. Is number two High Eye? Because when she lands on the village, one of the first shots we see is the old eyeball camera that were on the village spying on her. But is that number six? Our number six?
See, it could be. I mean, I like the idea that it's not someone that we know. Again, it's that kind of unnerving fear of there's always someone else watching, which lends itself more to that. That even if it was someone that we know, I don't want to know.
Well, again, though,
Bissigna.
Lee's doing the Bissigna sign.
Yeah.
Which is a really subtle little artistic thing.
Yeah, I picked up on that.
Which is good. The Vorpal Blade is Alice's weapon in Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
Referring to the Jabberwocky, so that's obviously where she gets to the thing here. There's loads of allusions to the TV show. Actual stills approach, as we mentioned, for Thomas driving to HQ. When Alice lands on the beach of the village, close-ups of Alice looking through the window, McGowan, essentially what McGowan does in the opening credits.
Mm.
It didn't seem like this would be a big test of her sailing skills if everything is computerized, but by the same token, this is probably the first time this was done.
Yeah, and I think they do mention as well that she's essentially just going on a cruise.
Yeah.
She just wants to get away.
Yeah, and she's essentially saying, I will test your new computer abilities.
Yeah.
And it seems really weird now that this was such a brand new thing then. But now that's pretty much how everything works, isn't it?
Well, I think it helped that it definitely ground itself within that time, because otherwise there's a few things that don't quite work.
Yes, that thing here. Because I read a review as well that was basically said, so why does she go sunbathing in a bikini? Well, what do you want her to sunbathe?
She's on a cruise. What else is it going to do?
The computers are pretty much handling everything for her.
Yeah.
This is just her chance to get away. She has to do the sales manually and know all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was a silly criticism. She's bathing in a bikini. Well, what do you think she's going to do? You want to walk around nude?
Yeah.
Or not at all? Well, I didn't get it.
Fully dressed out at the sea.
Yeah, I didn't get it as a criticism. The end of book one is, like you say, it's Alice's arrival in the village. So you've had an awful lot of backstory that you never got. The penny farthing is crashed on the beach, which I didn't understand.
No, but I liked it as a visual indicator of time has passed. You recognise this, but it's buried in sand. It's 20 years later.
But what I liked about it was the panel there, which is looking at it ostensibly through the spokes.
Right,
but there have been numerous panels throughout this entire first issue where she is behind bars. Yeah.
Mm.
So I thought that was quite a clever visual reference.
Did you, when you were reading this, did you hear the little twangs of the soundtrack and the theme tune?
Yeah, I find at this point, this is when you hear Ron Grainer's do, do, do.
It was the slow do, 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 do.
Yeah, but and then when she starts exploring the visage, it's hard not to hear. All that stuff.
It's the one that was like a My Barney lies over the ocean.
Yeah, that one's in there. There's a lot of fairy tale ones in it. She arrives at the village. Again, it looks like photo reference, but he's like in your introduction or whatever, he's obviously doctored them to make the village look ever so slightly run down.
I think the colour nails it. The unnatural saturated lighting, like the colour does a lot of good work here, and it works with the contrast of he's clearly altered the saturation of the photos to make them heavy blacks.
Yeah.
And then he's adjusted the colours to work with it. It's really visually interesting.
Well, like we were just talking about when she gets there. And the fascinating thing about this is if you've been to Port Marion as well.
Yeah, you recognise.
You recognise all of this. Yeah. It's brilliant.
Which is quite interesting. It's one of the things I have to keep reminding myself. It's a big deal in this. No one knows where the village is.
Yeah.
Really. But I'm like, it's in Wales, mate.
Yeah, it's in Wales. 2.5 hours down the motorway, you're there. But what I like about it is that the panel when she arrives that we just talked to, it's the eyeball scanning thing that you see on the village. It's hidden in a bust.
But it's damaged.
Is that deliberately drawn to look like Magoo's shadow?
Right, okay.
I thought that was a cute little visual motif as well. And then she pulls back and it's the bust of the Roman whatever that it was. I never recognised it, but whatever. But the exploration of the village is all handled pretty much no dialogue. She doesn't talk to herself.
And it builds up to it. It's this slow, she starts on the beach and she walks slowly further and further into the heart of the village as well.
And it's all perfectly choreographed. Again, if you've been to Port Marion, the series would fudge locations quite a lot because they had to make the village seem bigger than it really is.
Yeah.
You can walk around Port Marion in 25 minutes.
Mm.
It's not that big. But this, where you would get off at the beach and then the walk towards the Green Dome is pretty much accurate to this.
Yeah, yeah.
What Alice does here.
Which makes me wonder, is that the co-writer who did a lot of the research, or is that the artist, with it being so...
I wonder if he's said to him, right, if you were on the beach, this is the route that you would take to get you where you want her to go.
Yeah.
And he sent him photos. You'd see this on the way, you'd see this on the way, and he's gone, right, I'll incorporate all that.
Probably one of the bigger benefits of actually having an actual location.
Mm.
And it helps as well. Port Marion, in and of it, probably why they chose it for the show. Mm. Port Marion itself is a visually striking place.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It's an amalgamation of so many different things that shouldn't work, but just it's Yours. So visually interesting.
Yeah. We had a look at staying there.
Yeah.
It's not cheap.
It's not cheap. No, well, I think we were thinking of going and taking cats, but no dogs are allowed.
No dogs allowed in the village.
I know.
That's a shame. I liked McGowan's number 6's dialogue in this.
Mm.
It's very clipped and full of double meaning and smart ass in that way that he could be.
And it's more joyful to read it in his voice as well. Yeah,
and you can.
Yeah.
So the writer really does a good job of capturing that.
I think the only problem with the dialogue is there is a lot of times where it feels a bit unnatural because it wants to bring in a quote from the show.
Yeah, it wants to evoke what was said in the opening titles.
Every once in a while, there'll be like a be seeing you. Whatever. Everyone says that. But then every once in a while, she'll go... you won't get it by hook or by crook, we will.
That felt a bit. Yeah. But when she says, who are you? That would be telling.
Yeah.
That's all. He's basically reenacting the opening credits.
I did also read it as, you are number six.
Yeah.
I love that little double meaning.
Yeah, it's really clever. Book B, again, opens with lots of just shots of the village. She's in Six's apartment, which coincidentally looks like her apartment because she lives in Six's apartment. There's some semblance of explanation for Alice's behaviour. And it's more relatable than Six.
Mm.
In an episode, Six says he resigned for peace of mind. And Alice is not only quitting her job, she's quitting everything. She's quitting the rat race. She's quitting her life.
Yeah.
She's essentially had enough of the work, her marriage. She's even had enough of being a mum, which I always think is a very big step for a woman, particularly,
right,
to take. She's quit everything. She's had enough of everything. Today, we'd say that this was a mental health thing.
Mm.
So, but this was, what, 1987, so they didn't really discuss that then. But that's clearly what it is.
And I suppose that that kind of lends itself into the narrative more, especially when mental health is this big unwritten theme of this book.
Yeah.
It deals with how does this imprisonment affect these characters. Just by number six being here is the kind of idea that prisoners don't adapt to being outside of prison.
Mm.
How many times was a prisoner then like a
reoffended
reoffend to get back into it? And so you've got here someone who's tried his entire, well, however long it was that he was in the village, to get out. He was then given an open door and chose to say,
chose to get
I'm
back
gonna
in.
Stay here.
Yeah,
it's those really interesting concepts of your mental stability, your ideas of what is imprisonment.
Mm.
Like, is this a prison now or is this home to him?
There's lots of cute players on words. Alice asks Six if he was born here, and he says born here.
Yeah,
like meaning he was transported here.
In this bit where they're driving around,
mm.
is her outfit the Asian lady who's driving him around yes. in the first episode?
With the little, it's very cosmopolitan. You'll never know who you'll meet. Yeah, the straw boater and the blue and white sailor's outfit and the white pants. I like that she doesn't adopt the blazer.
Right.
That he yeah, was. Yeah. That's quite cool.
And I like that he still keeps it. He's still holding on to everything he tried so hard to expel.
Well, this is what, again, another theme of it, which was also a theme of the show. Are we all just a prisoner of ourselves?
Mm.
Do we keep ourselves locked in? Do we keep those barriers in place? I don't know. The question I had here, does Six know number two is here? Our Six, Magooan Six, does he know Leo McKern's here? The Darjeeling tea was provided by somebody else. Because he says later, he didn't do this.
Mm.
He didn't provide her with that. So, because initially he's quite welcoming of her.
Yeah.
And then after this, he starts being distrusting of her. So does he know two's there? And if he does know, then he should have seen him arrive. And if he doesn't know, how did number two get to the village?
I don't know.
That's never explained, is it? It's just, you know. I like that the chessboard is still
cracked.
Even though we never saw that in another episode.
Why not?
No.
It's right in the centre, though.
It is net.
Right.
Now, Port Merryn have actually put the chessboard there.
Oh, right.
But in the show, I'm sure it's only in checkmate.
Right, okay.
Unless it's stock.
Because I've only ever seen it there in Port Merryn. So I assumed that it was Port Merryn. So in actuality, it was the show that bled into...
And then Port Merryn put it, they liked the look of it, so they put it there.
Right.
They felt it fit in with the aesthetic.
Yeah.
And it also, every year when they do the Six of One conventions...
Yes, yeah.
They can reenact all
that. This is 2018, apparently.
Didn't it?
No. I did like him just setting up the scarecrows just seemed like a thing that he did as part of a routine, and then you find out later it's a booby trap.
Yep. But again, it's a subtle piece of storytelling if you're not paying attention. You finally do realise that Leo McKern's here after he makes the fish.
Yeah, the panels at the bottom of each page.
Yeah. That's a really good piece of storytelling. The top three panels or four panels of every page are telling Six and Six's story, Alice's story. Whereas the bottom, you're seeing number two arrive in the village with the butler.
Yeah.
So initially, is he got a gun? He's got the pictures. I don't know why he would need the picture if he knows where he's going. But then he arrives and it doesn't show us how he gets there. So we can assume, I don't know, maybe he knows secret entrance ways from when he was number two.
Yeah.
That Six isn't aware of. I don't know. Number two's account of fallout is that they, whoever they are, had won. And Six had been broken. But even if we allow for fallout to be a drug-fueled hallucination, then Six walked away in the penultimate episode, Once Upon a Time, from a clear victory.
Right.
So is two deleting himself?
Could be.
Or can he not allow for the fact that he was defeated? Is the ego coming into it?
I mean, it could be both, especially if you're that person who's in charge as well. I don't know.
I like seeing Rover. She does adopt the blazer. She adopts the blazer. Oh, yeah, he gives it when it's cold, doesn't he?
But she only wears it that once, doesn't she?
Yeah. She doesn't carry it. She wears it because it's gone a bit cold. Well, it is Wales.
You think he did that on purpose? Like, he knew that it, like, Rover only goes chasing after people with the blazer?
No, because isn't he only he? Oh no, number two wears the blazers.
Everyone wears the blazer, don't they?
Well, I don't think the guy in the shop does.
Right.
It was nice to see Rover again, and that they make no effort whatsoever to explain who Rover is. Which is
was there ever any effort to explain what Rover is?
No, there never was. It was really weird when you saw that he had kids, or she had kids.
The
Rovers.
I don't remember.
It was mini Rovers.
Mini
Rovers. So he was like, well, okay, so is Rover is Rover alive? Maybe. Rover had children.
I do.
So is there more than one Rover?
I did always lend into the belief that Rover was sentient, which makes it even more scary.
Yeah. I like the idea that he's sentient as well. Confrontation between number two and Alice's number six, I really liked. Especially the bit, he was a murderer. Who did he murder? Me.
Yeah.
Which is also leading into Leo McKern's off-screen heart attack.
Right.
As a result of those scenes being really intense and McGoohan really going at him.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of meta commentary going on there. I like how they age him, but again, the line between John Drake and number six, because that's a still of his John Drake.
I did, because I remember, yeah. But that's used in The Prisoner, isn't it?
It's the one that they cross out in the opening credits to say that he's resigned.
Which is kind of a nice bit of storytelling in and of itself. This isn't Danger Man, this is The Prisoner.
Yeah, but, you know, it is Danger Man, really. So there's lots of really clever... I liked it. I like there's lots of dialogue changes and stuff like that in. Tom, meanwhile, back away from the village, Tom and Lee are doing what they do. Tom calls Lee at 6 o'clock in the morning and he says, wrong number. What number is he? You see what I did there?
Double meanings.
All over the place.
I like the boat. There's a lot of emphasis on the boat. Which is also real.
Yeah, the stone boat is there, yeah. For you to go and stand on and pretend that you're doing whatever you're doing. The radio seems to be all over the place. He seems to have the radio on and the TV on, and there's lots of different news stories going on, some of which were relevant to the times.
So were these real things?
Some of it were. The power stations in Gloucestershire, Britain's original Magnox station, all that stuff about nuclear power, all that was a real thing in the late 80s.
Yeah.
I did like that it's a throwaway line, that mysterious deaths of British defence scientists.
Yeah, right.
Because you get to the end and you realise somebody is picking off all the people who know about the village.
Yes, yeah.
So that's introduced really subtly. I didn't understand why they're keeping the village at all. And if they're assassinating the people involved with it, maybe they're not. But there seemed to be some contradiction in how much they knew about it. If they've had access to it for the past 20 years, why have they not done something about it already? Why have they left Six there on his own?
Well, because they haven't left him on his own, have they? They have just let everyone go.
Mm.
He's chosen to stay.
But they've kept the power on for him.
Yeah.
And they've kept a supply of food going there for him.
Yeah.
Because they actually say that.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. But whether it's a case of they don't know why it's still there. Someone else does.
Yeah.
And it's because of the nuke there.
Right.
Is my no prize.
Right. No, that's as good a no prize as any.
Because that's the thing is, there's so many unanswered questions, but it's also because ultimately, like The Prisoner, we're dealing with an unreliable narrator.
Yes. In numerous different places.
Which I feel is sometimes a bit of a lazy excuse sometimes, but
yeah.
It's also one of those things that you are dealing with a spy organisation, like there is going to be a lot of the kind of things.
Yeah, that's true. Did they ever make Lee's plans clear? He's not working with Ross, Tom's boss, as Ross doesn't seem to know who he is, because he's the one who shows him the photo of him
and says, "Who's this?"
when he's handing over the floppy disk.
Yeah.
So he doesn't seem to know who he is. So what's Lee gaining from all this? Now, he's working for the Archangels.
Yeah.
We know that. He refers to a Mr. Smiley. George Smiley is the lead character in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Right.
So was that just a nod, or was that there for a specific reason? Because at the end of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, George Smiley takes control of the department that he works for after the death of his control.
Because my reading of it, or my interpretation, was he is doing all this. He's helping out his mate because he wants in to get to the island. And he wants to get into the village because the higher-ups have told him to, and there's something there that he needs to retrieve.
Yeah, the riddle of the village is what they call it.
But it's the 12 and 2. It's their little internal fight that kind of throws a spanner in the works that ultimately means he isn't successful.
No.
But
because he's not CIA or FBI, we learn.
Yeah. He works for the higher-ups.
Yeah, so, and he ends up dying at the end.
But that was just my reading. He's been sent with a mission by the Archangels that ultimately is not successful because of the internal conflict between 6 and 2.
Right. It's all very wheels within wheels, this stuff.
But again, that's just what I put together, yeah.
The end of book 3, there's an awful lot of chat about the Village Idiot book and how Thomas has significantly rewrote a lot of what number 2.
And I liked this.
Yeah, I like that. He's rewrote to make it seem more fictional.
Yeah.
Even though it's been posited as a true story.
Yeah.
He's making it seem like people will go, no way.
Yeah.
It's basically, I liked this because I just read the biography of James Bond.
Right.
Where the premise of that is James Bond has become too famous.
Yeah.
So Ian Fleming writes books about James Bond so that other agencies will think, well, this guy can't be real then.
Yeah, yeah.
He must be a myth that the British Secret Service have created.
Well, I think there's a throwaway line in You Only Live Twice.
Mm.
M writes Bond's obituary.
Yeah.
And he just goes, James never liked the fact that he was a public figure because of some books that if they were any more realistic, we would have had to place him under arrest.
Where the biographer has M approve each of the books.
Right, okay.
He's particularly like the ones where he comes out well.
Right, that's quite interesting because it is implied in that bit in You Only Live Twice that M did not approve, but because they were never quite... It's like the story of, was it Stanley Kubrick got arrested and questioned by the US government because he set designed the inside of the plane cockpit so accurately that the US government were like, how did you know?
And he's, well, it's they, just designed.
Well, because he asked for permission to go inside so he could build it from reference. They said, no, it's a government secret.
So he's built it himself.
So he built it, but he built it so accurately the government were like, what the fuck?
Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. The fight between the two of them at the end. I love the cricket metaphor.
Mm.
I love all that cricket metaphor stuff that goes on. The 6 and 2 end up getting into a physical brawl at the end. And I wasn't sure who went over the edge in the fight. So they have this big fight in the rain. There's one of those big wheel turny things that has a proper name that I'm blanking on at the minute.
Yeah.
And one of them goes over.
Mm.
And the implication is it's 6 that goes over. And I like that line, my life is my own, then take it.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite fun. But the next shot we see of 6, Patrick McGowan's 6, is back in his apartment in the village, shaving off his beard.
Yeah.
So 6 didn't go over. But number 2's okay. Because this is the last we see of old number 6 until the very end of book 4. He's not in book 4 at all until the end.
Well, I mean, he's hers quite straggly, so I thought it was him who went over.
Right.
And
but he didn't die, obviously.
Because, again, my interpretation, the reason why he's shaven is because he lost that fight. He's old, he's trapped in this cycle, he needs to free himself from he's let himself go, so he needs to bring himself back, and that's why he's shaven.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not BS.
Alice leaves them to it because she's fed up of all of this,
which I love. That was great. Like, this isn't my fight, I don't care.
Yeah, kill each other, I'm not watching. She walks past Rover on the beach, obviously ostensibly though to stop her from leaving. That's what Rover does. We don't see her again until the end of book 4.
No,
they're not even the main characters as you go into book 4, which actually gets a little bit confusing.
Mm.
That's what it is. Book 4 gives Ross, who's Thomas's head of section, much more to do. And he starts pulling together all the threads that lead to either, so tell me if you agreed with this interpretation, a conspiracy to destroy the village, or to get number 6, or something else entirely that I'm not sure.
For me, it was something else entirely. There is the village secret.
Yeah.
That they want, and we don't know what that is.
Right, so we never find the riddle of the village.
Unless the secret is the bomb, because the nuclear bomb would be a massive thing in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it also quite possibly wouldn't have been knowledge within the organization itself.
Mm.
Because that's depicted as the plot twist. They were there for the nuclear missile underneath. Yeah. So unless they wanted the bomb, that gives them power. That makes them a national global power.
Yeah. Well, Ross refuses to give in his investigation, doesn't he?
Mm.
And then he ends up being taken by the same funeral guards that took number six in the show. Is he taken to the village?
Well, it's...
We never find that out.
No, because it is just another cute little, oh, I know what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And I liked that when he goes to resign, his boss is a new person.
Yeah.
Because that goes back to a new number two.
Yeah. And a guy who just wants his resignation. And he, the last we see of him, he's drugged and taken away.
Yeah.
Is he taken to the village?
Is there another village?
Is there another village? Yeah, because the village in the end of this isn't as destroyed as we were led to believe.
Hmm.
Who stood on the stone boat?
And who's watching from inside?
Yeah, and who's watching from inside?
It's implied that there's someone watching.
Yeah.
So did six and two, I believe.
Yeah. If the nuclear warhead detonated, why is the village still standing? Because it looks to me, looking at that now, that the person on the stone boat is Lee.
Well, did the warhead detonate or did it just launch?
Yeah, it launches.
Oh, and it detonates above the earth. So
the village should not exist anymore.
Unless that was the plan. There's something at the village they want to protect. So what best way to protect it than to irradiate it?
Yeah. And so is Lee dead? I can't make out who it is who stood on the stone boat at the end though. But it looks like Lee.
Hmm. I don't know.
I don't know that either.
And it's one of those things where part of me likes
the ambiguity of it. Because it's the prisoner.
But that's it. Is this loose threads? Is this overlooked plot holes? Or is this similar to the finale of The Prisoner? Let's mm-hmm. be brutally honest.
Yeah.
Incredibly sloppy. Is it intentionally sloppy to mirror that? Is it unintentionally sloppy? There's all these things of just like, and it's this might just be like BS, and and to some people they might kind of take it differently, but for me it's kind of one of those things where it's difficult to objectively state it, because is that the intention of it, or is it unintentionally missing plot threads, or is it intentionally doing it to make it ambiguous? Is it intentionally sloppy, quote unquote, to mirror the sloppiness of the season finale to make it more in tune with that? Or it's one of those things where it could literally be anything.
Mm-hmm.
It could just be the case of they just did a poor job of wrapping things up.
I don't think they did.
Because they're so good at every other thing, yeah.
I think everything that's done here is intentional. And he's got an idea of what that intention is.
Mm.
But he's leaving it to you to decide what you think that intention is.
So,
because how did Six and Alice get out of the village? They're here sat on a park bench in presumably London, because she's back with her daughter at the end. So Six isn't in the village anymore.
No.
And she actually says, who was number one? And Six's cryptic answer is, does the presence of number two require the existence of number one?
Oh, that was cute. I liked that, yeah.
And he says that his secrets are safe, even though his secrets are 20 years out of date. Because that was a big deal throughout the story as well.
Because he's clinging on. He's not as important as he wants to believe he is.
Good luck with your gardening.
Yeah.
What's that implying? I don't know. But seeing you. And he just walks off.
I mean, that is quite actually interesting now thinking about that. And that could have been really interesting if followed through on a bit more. Like, he's clinging on to these secrets, thinking he's a very important person. But
he isn't.
What happens when you learn that you're not as relevant as you want to be?
Well, nothing he knows will be 20 years down the line.
Yeah.
It won't be relevant
anymore.
So,
again, that leads into the fact that you are your own prisoner.
Yeah. As a sequel to something that didn't need a sequel, this is actually pretty good.
Yes.
I enjoyed it. Thematically, it's certainly Prisoner-esque.
Mm.
From the idea that all of society is designed to keep us down in some way, to the idea that none of us are really free. What is it Bill Hicks used to say? Try getting anywhere without money if you think you're free. We all have bills, commitments, jobs, etc. It even follows the series in that barely any of the questions raised are answered.
Mm.
But it also seems to want to be a straight-up spy drama. Like I've mentioned, it feels very much like Edge of Darkness, which would have been contemporary when this was written.
Right.
It is still one of the BBC's. If that's on iPlayer, check it out.
Okay.
Edge of Darkness is brilliant. Jordan Baker. That's his name. That's Wade from the Pierce Brosnan Bond movies, isn't
it?
Right. Jordan Baker is his Lee.
Okay.
In that
right.
series.
Yeah.
Bob Peck's the British Secret Service agent. Joe Don Baker's the American CIA agent, and he's always got the loud Hawaiian shirts on, like in Bond. It's good. It's really good.
Okay.
If you've never seen Edge of Darkness work, check it out. And like I said, with having watched Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and the Ewan McGregor thing, Our Kind of Traitor, which is also that's on Netflix.
Okay.
So if you want to check that out, that's really good. It felt like a blending of Le Carre and traditional spy, but with enough of the prisoner in it to make it entertaining. I can't decide whether it does actually undo Fallout. But if it does, it then redoes Fallout.
Yeah.
So that seems weird. Because it is a similar ending with the nuclear thing going off. But what you're dealing with here, even 25 years ago, 35 years ago that this was, you've got various world governments and powers that be used more and more, using more CCTV surveillance, deep fake manipulation, cell phone tracking, identity cards, all these other forms of insidious control that you don't think of as being control. Like, it amuses me no end when people talk about the deep state monitoring us. Have you got a smartphone? They've been monitoring you for a while.
Yeah.
And we see in many ways the prisoner is more relevant than ever. It also makes about as much sense as life does.
Well, it was quite fascinating because initially going into it, I was a little reluctant. I didn't know what I would make of it, and I didn't know, if anything, what I would have to say about it. And I found myself being more and more captivated. It's been a while since I've watched The Prisoner properly, fully. And even then, I never really had this great affinity of it. I watched it and I enjoyed it. And I've got a nice little big poster of it in my house. And, like, you know, that's it. But I found myself being more and more captivated by it because my first kind of worry was, oh, it's the people behind the curtain. I don't want to know about this. I don't want my questions to be answered. And then the more I'm reading, the more answers, the questions that are answered, the more questions are being left. And the more curtains you peek behind, the more curtains are. And it really did remind me quite a lot of The Invisibles.
Yeah. Well, hasn't Grant Morrison said The Invisibles was heavily influenced by The Prisoner?
Quite possibly as well. And it's that kind of thing where it's genuinely unnerving to know that you are constantly being watched. But then who is watching The Watchmen, you know, as it would be? It's and it feels like a weird kind of art house piece. There's always that question. I was watching quite recently a documentary / interview with the Pet Shop Boys. And
the one on BBC Four?
Yeah. And Neil Tennant was asked, are the Pet Shop Boys art or arty? And Chris Lowe just brushes it off and goes, oh, we're just farty, mate. And
which sounds like Chris Lowe.
And Neil Tennant actually thinks about it very seriously, but it reminded me a lot of this. Is this art or arty? Does it border on pretentiousness for the sake of it? Or is it actually weighed down with that gravity? And it was very kind of interesting. This presents itself as Chris Lowe, but speaks as Neil Tennant. It's very interesting, that kind of thing of just, it was a fascinating little thing. And I could probably quite happily not read it again, but it's just this weird little nugget of a gem that I was quite pleasantly surprised by.
Was too. I was, especially seeing as like you had heard not good things about it over the years.
Yeah.
To actually sit and read it and go, actually, there's nothing really wrong with this.
And a lot of the critiques that I read was just like, oh, it undermines the TV show, that does this. Which leads me to believe, I think a lot of people like what they know, and anything new or a continuation of that thing they know, they automatically are defensive. And I didn't remember The Prisoner of being this, you know, paramount of great storytelling. It was just...
It was a 1960s TV show where they were making it up as they go along.
Just make stuff up, yeah.
But it also, the thing with it that I think that the remake didn't work was The Prisoner is the definition of a show made at that time by those people in that space.
Yeah.
And what everyone seems to, when they do these remakes and reboots and stuff, they always seem to ignore that the time and the place that the art happens
are just as important.
Yeah. Whether that art be The Prisoner or The A-Team or Star Wars or whatever.
Yeah.
The time that that lands is just as important. Well, is The X-Files as popular 10 years later?
Well, there's always the argument, isn't there? Is content anything without context?
Yeah.
And that's why this, I think this works by grounding it. This goes out of its way to tell you when it was set. And that's why that works. If The Prisoner is the 60s,
well, it is,
this is the 80s. This reads like the 80s.
Yeah, it is 1987.
And that's what makes it work better than if it was just an ambiguous period of time.
Mm. Yeah, I agree entirely. Anyway, let's have a look at another email. And then we will be coming back to the prisoner. But we'll, but we've actually got a couple of emails, so I want to get, and we've got a very special email as well. Martin Gray sent us a Facebook message, but I felt this one was worth delving into. Hi, Martin. This was a fun show, the Doom Patrol fun show. Mm-hmm. It's always interesting to hear views on things that I've been reading forever from sharp people who are slightly less familiar. He thinks we're sharp. It's better than being blunt, I guess. Given how much you both enjoyed that first issue of My Greatest Adventure, I think it would be worth investing in the omnibus. Checks price. Maybe not. I should sell mine. Okay, read My Greatest Adventure and the original Doom Patrol series at DC Infinite. If I had DC Infinite, I would. Andy, why did you keep calling Worm a girl? Bad enough he gets blown up without the poor kid being miswatcheted. I apologise profusely. I didn't remember doing that, but in a story about some guy saying, this is what I want to be called, I got that wrong. So you were right to call me out on that, because that's how we get better. I really like the recent series, apart from the inclusion of Peacemaker, whose current characterization exists only to make Guy Gardner look slightly less terrible. Very true. Surprisingly, the Superman Night Terrors issues were very good. They treated Supergirl well. Oh, okay. So will you be subscribing to Waiting for Doom, which is a Doom Patrol podcast?
Oh, is it? That was a nice little ad, that was.
You slipped that in. You've not tried Sugar and Spike. It's as awesome as everyone says. Right now, there's a copy of the number one facsimile on eBay for $1.99. And you love facsimiles. I do.
What was Sugar and Spike?
We mentioned that it was mentioned in an advert in the My Greatest Adventure reprint, right, and neither one of us knew what it was.
Right, got it. But now we have the opportunity.
But now I may have a look on eBay and purchase that facsimile. Maybe we should come back to it.
Or maybe. Yeah, little addendum.
Yeah, we'll come back to Sugar and Spike at some point in the future, seeing as we seem to be in an era of Hey Kids comics where nothing is off the table anymore.
Yeah.
Are we actively covering stuff that audiences are going to go, nah, to?
Yeah, we've got to catch them off guard. Right. It's the only way you can
remain. Yeah, but if they're listening.
It's the only way you can remain interested.
Okay, fair enough. Michael Ananda says, it's the Michael Bailey email.
Good, they're back.
Yeah. I honestly thought about sending this as a voice message, but decided against it because I like to go back and listen to these again. And found when I re-listened to the episode where I sent in audio during the Civil War episode, where I provided commentary for the novelization of that event at Andy's request, I start yelling at myself to shut the f*** up. I feel like this is your show and the voices should be yours, even if the text isn't. And if I'm being honest, I tend to format these things with how I imagine Andy will read them. Honestly, Michael could read them too. This is the result of listening to y'all for over a decade. Wow.
I mean, he does get messages from you more often, so he probably can capture your voice.
That's probably true, yeah. On the subject of the email section, I have a theory why the feedback hasn't been as robust as it was in the old days. Oh, there you go. It's like we planned this.
Yeah.
Back then, you mainly covered mainstream material that the general audience was more familiar with. The feedback on the more esoteric or independent books you covered was thinner than when you covered something that had more light on it. So it makes a weird kind of sense that since you are focusing more on off-the-beaten-path material with the new show, the feedback might follow that pattern. That is literally what we just said.
It is good that we've got someone from the outside who can analyse it for us as well. That's quite,
true. That it's not that we don't like modern day Marvel or DC. It's not that we're on a downer on modern day Marvel or DC. I think with me, it's simply a case of I've read Batman or Superman or the Hulk or Spider-Man or whatever for 40 odd years now. And at some point, you are going to go, this isn't giving me anything new.
No, and it's always interesting. There's more stuff out there. I say that when I reread the Ra's al Ghul facsimile, like I just felt absolute joy after reading it. It's like, we should cover this on a show, and then we have been. But yeah, there's more stuff out there, and it makes it more interesting. You know, how many times can you do another Batman story? Like, yeah, there's plenty of them, but
are they all at this point very, like Michael said to me in a message, the new Superman Warlord book, he said, is very, very good.
Right,
the new House of Brainiac is really good.
That's the current one, isn't
That's
it?
The current one. But he's also saying these are just reworkings of Exile and Panic in the Sky that he read 30-odd years ago.
Yeah.
So there comes a point where you as a reader must surely go, instead of bitching that they're not as good as they used to be, maybe look at yourself a bit and go, maybe it's time for me to just walk away. Even if it's only for a bit,
yeah.
Just take a break, have a look what else is out there.
Yeah.
Because I think it's telling that at yesterday's free comic book day, I didn't pick up Marvel or DC's books.
Mm.
I picked up Gacha Man.
Because well, you did it, yeah,
planets, because
yeah.
I love it. And I picked up Initial D for You and Conan. And what else did I get? Star Wars.
Yeah.
And something else that I forget at the minute. But I would have got the Doctor Who, but they'd sold them all, so they didn't have any.
Yeah.
Sold. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'll have to get that free off Comixology.
Well, it's just there's loads of different things, and there's so many other different podcasts, you know, that deal with these things.
Yeah.
Like, there's probably already, you know, off the top of my head, there's the Superman podcast, there's the Guy Gardner podcast, there's mm-hmm. and there's already all of these, and, you know, not only are you retreading on the same books, you're also retreading on the same books that have been discussed by other shows.
Yeah, possibly more knowledgeable than us.
Yeah.
It's one of the things we mentioned in our little 3 minute, we're coming back, but it won't be the show as you remember it. Because we actually sat down before, because you said you wanted to do it again.
Yeah.
And I said, but what are we bringing now that is different? There are far more comic book podcast now, including by professionals and professional companies.
We were doing it first.
Than when we started.
Yeah.
We weren't first. It wasn't as many.
Yeah.
And what are you bringing now that is different? And by definition, if you're doing something different, it's not going to be as popular.
Mm.
That's just the way it is. But at the same time, I would rather do something different than a rehash past glories. Or B, try and do the show in a way that doesn't feel natural for us. And at the moment, it doesn't feel natural for us to just cover Batman or Spider-Man or Superman, although we do a lot of Superman.
Yeah.
We did one last week, last time, last month, whatever. Yeah. And it feels more natural to me at this moment to let's shine a light on the other stuff we're enjoying that isn't the big two. That is not to say big two won't stuff come into it next month.
Yeah,
is stuff from the big two. It's probably not what you're going to think it's going to be. And I'll mention that at the end of the show. But that's just where we are at the minute. You're not interested in the massive big events that DC and Marvel are doing.
No.
I couldn't tell you what massive big events Marvel and DC are doing.
And it's just, reading a lot of other stuff that's just more, I'm reading Dragon Ball and I'm trying to think of how I'm going to do a Dragon Ball Z at some point down the line.
Yeah, okay.
And it's just those other little things. Of like, I think it's more, one of the benefits of doing it monthly, not weekly, is there's more freedom to kind of sit and think, well, what do I want to do? Or if you're reading something and go, all right, well, we'll pull this one out. Yeah. Instead of having to just kind of essentially fill it and like you're just kind of grabbing things like, well, we're going to do that next week, we're going to do that next week. It's more a case of there's just that more freedom now to actually think about what you're going to cover.
Yeah, and give it more thought.
Yeah.
And also, by definition, by not being weekly, we can't do stuff like 8 weeks of Nightfall anymore.
Mm.
That's 8 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those big kind of crossover things, they're off the table.
Well, it's made it more difficult because, you know, we've discussed doing Akira, but how do you break that down into
Akira?
Just the one show? We've just
Lone Wolf and Cub. We've wanted to do Lone Wolf and Cub for years.
But we've worked out how to do that. It's just actually having read it.
Yeah. We've got to read it all and then cherry pick the best moments.
Yeah.
That's gonna be a while away.
So, but it does, it does make it difficult. Like, we try and keep it down to 90 minutes, so it cuts out the big ones. But then the big ones that we want to do, I said that and you had to check.
I'm like 85 minutes now, but we've not finished yet.
But the big ones that you then want to do, you've then got to think, well, right, well, how do I fit that into the format? We're weirdly more free now, but also more structured.
Yeah, and there's also the thing is I don't want to pick something that you're objectively going to hate or be bored by.
Which was always the thing that was always the case of you don't, we're not here to shit on something.
Yeah.
If we end up not liking it, then
that's a different thing. Because I don't trust people who like everything.
Mm.
Just as much as I hate these YouTube channels that hate everything.
Yeah.
There's like, well, what's your agenda though? If you hate everything, why are you even bothering? Go off and find a different hobby.
Well, I think I've always kind of said that I don't believe that you are a fan of something if you cannot critique something.
Yeah.
To kind of like it, you have to be aware of it enough to go, right, but, you know, to critique.
To go back to The Phantom Menace, I am well aware that The Phantom Menace is not a good movie. That does not mean I don't enjoy it.
Gonna stop rubbing hands.
It's not a good movie.
Yeah.
But I enjoy it.
No, but it is.
It's whatever. Should we go back to something? Not that I want you to change what you're doing, continues. Oh, that's nice. The new model is amazing. I'm getting exposed to books I wouldn't normally be aware of. Anyway, as far as this episode, I have to say I was surprised that Michael wasn't higher on Morrison's Doom Patrol, given his history with Morrison. I thought that maybe this would be more on his radar because of Morrison's run. I could have misinterpreted what he said, but I'm curious if Morrison's Doom Patrol run was one that Michael didn't like as much as Grant's other work, or if he didn't go into it because the point was to talk about this story. Go on, answer that.
Well, I think what it is, I had a weird experience reading Morrison's Doom Patrol. I can't remember if I read it before or after The Invisibles, but I read it. I think you picked me up a few issues from like 50p bins and I borrowed the rest off Scott.
Mm.
But I read it in a very fragmented way, which probably isn't the best way to read something by Morrison.
Some might say it's the only way to read stuff by Morrison.
And I don't know if it's because I read it. I must have been about 12, 13, 14, somewhere around that ballpark. But I read The Invisibles at the same kind of period of time. And I just don't know what it was. I just didn't feel pulled in. And I kept meaning to kind of go back and to reread it, because by all accounts, it should be right up my alley.
Yeah, it's quintessential Morrison.
And it interested me. It opened up me into, you know, the Dadaist art movement and that kind of thing. Whenever I'm in London, I will always go to the Tate Modern to see Marcel Duchamp's The Fountain because of Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol run. So it did have this big influence, but it was just one of those where the story itself, the comics itself, I don't know, it just didn't grip me. Now, whether that was age or whatever. So I've always wanted to go back and reread it.
Do you have it all?
No.
Right.
But it's, again, it's just one of those where, you know, you kind of say to yourself, oh, well, I'll pick it up at some point. But that at some point never comes around.
Is it in an omnibus?
It's in an omnibus, which is probably like £100, or it's in like three,
like epic collection kind of
things. Three kind of like trades, yeah. So it's one of those that I kept meaning to revisit and see what I thought of it now. But at the time, it just didn't click when it should. And even I'm kind of thinking back on going, why? Possibly because I read them as fragmented chunks in individual issues, but right. I don't know. So this one, it was mostly only because of I knew Chris Burnham was doing it, and it was a mini that I was like, all right, well, you know, go on then.
Michael continues, I was shocked that Andy likes facsimile editions. Total surprise. Could have knocked me over the fence. I've not made a secret of it.
No.
I have actually said, if they published Amazing Spider-Man, Steve Ditko, those first 38 issues, as facsimile, I would totally buy them all again.
I've started adding them to my list now.
So I am buying all the Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yes, so am I.
And all the Secret Wars. Don't even like Secret Wars.
And there's the Sergeant, not the Sergeant Rock one.
I've ordered the Sergeant Rock one, yeah.
And the Black Hawks
one. I've ordered the Black Hawks one, yeah. Even the first appearance of Dazzler in X-Men.
Yeah,
about Dazzler. I mean, I care about Days of Future Past. That's why I bought that one.
Yeah.
I honestly think it's the best two-part story Marvel have ever told.
Do you think it's a bit naff, though, that they are kind of profiting off it by exploiting the collectible market, where you've now got variant covers of a facsimile? It's not a facsimile.
If it's a foil cover, it's not a facsimile. Yeah. And I would argue the facsimiles you should be selling for like $2 rather than full cover price.
The whole point of them is to get new readers in.
Let me go on record. If you're a retailer and you are slabbing facsimile editions and selling them for like 300 quid, you are a parasite.
Well, you say that. I did actually see someone selling, I can't remember what it was a slab of. Yes, I do. It was the first appearance of Ra's al Ghul.
Mm-hmm. The Treasury that's just come out.
No.
232.
Yeah, the green cover.
Yeah.
It was that slabbed, graded 9.8. So of course it is, because it's a new comic. Yeah. It's brand new.
Yeah. And how much were they selling it for?
I can't remember the price, but it was more than you would want to pay for a facsimile.
I realised through chats with Michael that they did a facsimile of Amazing Fantasy 15 and I didn't buy it.
Right.
I've got one, an annual number one, and all the others that they've done.
Mm.
And Amazing Fantasy 15, it's on eBay, slabbed for £300 and up.
Because isn't the whole point of them, not only to attract new readers, but also to kind of recreate that sensation of picking this up for the first time and reading it as it should be.
And having as close as, damn it, to a copy of Amazing Spider-Man 1 as I will ever own. So, and Hulk 1 and all of that stuff.
So it is scummy to completely ruin the intentions of that just for self-profit.
Who's buying those, though? Who's buying a slabbed facsimile for 300 quid?
Yeah, because it's that weird thing which is like, oh, I own a slabbed copy of Amazing Fantasy 15, brackets, small print, facsimile. It's like,
and it's one of those, I kind of understand facsimile, slabbing of like Amazing Fantasy 15 and Amazing Spider-Man 1 and Detective 27. They're not making any more of them. Preserving them is fine. But slabbing itself, I don't get it.
No. I mean, I just
it's
don't
not
like
my bag.
I just don't like slabbing. I never made any secret. Whenever we go to Marks and Cons and that, I hate slabbing because it is just, it's not preservation. It's
profiteering.
It's profiteering, and it's greed. It's that case of like, well, I own this, but you're not reading it.
Yeah.
What's the point? It's like the people who buy vinyl records just to get rid of the vinyl and stick the sleeve up on the wall. So, what are you doing? It's not
give me the vinyl.
It's not what it's meant to do. You are completely missing the point. Read the comic. Like, listen
a
to
comic
the record.
Is not a painting.
Yeah. If you really want to slab it, just print off a high-res photo and frame it or something. Like, it's the same thing.
It is really, that is really a movement that is a boat that's left me on the island.
Yeah.
Slapping. I just, no. Anyway. More than anything, Michael continues, this episode was a good example of y'all covering something you had some familiarity with, but hadn't dived into all that much. It sounded like a well-rounded story built for old and new audiences. It also sounds like it fits into the current ethos of DC, where they are doing series that are aimed at one particular part of the readership while still trying to grab new readers. It doesn't always work, but it's a noble effort and better than doing endless Batman crossovers. Picks up tea and looks into camera. Anyway, great job as always. Looking forward to the next one. Take Kurt, your best mate and president of the Gangbuster Fan Club. Mikey might be. Do you know what? I love that he don't let that go. Anyway, we are going to return to The Prisoner. Right, Titan Books currently have the license to The Prisoner. And Titan have republished this, Shattered Wizard. So that's the version that you would get now. Mm-hmm. They also did a new series called The Uncertainty Machine by Peter Milligan, Colin Lorimer. This takes a completely different tack in that it is just a brand new spy gets sent to the village.
Okay.
And that's it. There are no... McGowan's not in it. Leo McKern's not in it. It is literally a new person gets sent to the village. What is interesting to this is it quite clearly establishes, let me find it, that the head of the village is Jacob Rees-Mogg. He's not mentioned by name. And given where he ends up at the end of the story, I can only assume that Peter Milligan is not a fan of Mr. Rees-Mogg. But that's very definite the visual reference for
right.
Jacob Rees-Mogg, is it not? I found it interesting that one of the variant covers for this was your poster by Chris Weston.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. Big Finish get represented. It was all right. I didn't enjoy it as much as Shattered Visage.
Mm.
It's okay. It's not good. It's not bad. However, one thing that is good is that over the years, they've done a few different things with the property. We mentioned there was a few novels in the 60s and the laters, the terrible remake. Christopher Nolan is apparently trying to do a film of The Prisoner.
I don't think Nolan can do it.
Can go either way.
You need a degree of joy and camp. I don't think Nolan emanates camp.
He doesn't emanate joy in many ways, does he? Now, right, this is going to cause a few problems, so we'll try and do our best. Some of the more interesting attempts to resurrect the show appeared in the comics, as we've mentioned. The bullpen bulletin page in Marvel Comics, cover dated 1976, Marvel announced a comic book based on The Prisoner, to be written by Steve Englehart and drawn by artist Gil Kane. Coincidentally, for next month's episode, I've got to remember, we're not weekly anymore, this appears in The Eternals number one, a comic that heralded Jack Kirby's return to Marvel in the mid-70s after a run at DC Comics. When this happened, for reasons that no one seems to know, the property was transferred to Kirby. But only parts of it were lettered and inked by Mike Royer. The first issue was an adaptation of Arrival, the first episode of the television show. I told you this was big and I was going to knock stuff everywhere. And both were published in July 2018 in the original art edition. These editions are absolutely massive.
Yeah.
Which is why we're struggling right now to actually fit this on the table so we can discuss it. They are too big to store anywhere. Well, I'm very impressed with them, but this is the only one I'm going
to
buy.
Yeah, they're not meant to be like readable things, are they? They are like a visual.
Yeah, I saw it for 40 quid. This was 40 quid at a comic fair. So I had to borrow a tenner off your mum, but I bought it. And it's got both the Kirby and the Kane versions. And it's interesting to see the different approaches that they take. Of the Kirby stuff, only 5 pages are fully inked, with the odd panel here and there.
Kirby stuff looks... The likeness is weirdly on point, off point.
Yeah. From page 9, the lettering stops as well. So suddenly you want to get Kirby's notes. And, like, weirdly, some... The words that were going to be bold.
Yeah.
He's done those. So it's a fascinating look at a comic in progress. But it's a great look as well at Kirby's unfiltered and highly detailed pencils.
Yeah.
Which are absolutely fantastic.
It lends itself so well to the prison. There's a lot of Kirbyisms in there.
Yeah.
But it works in a way that it doesn't work at the same time. It's a bizarre amalgamation.
Yeah. The adaptation doesn't complete the episode. Rather, it promises new stories from this point. The next one is Kill Me If You Can.
Right.
Which was not an episode. So presumably this was going to be like Battlestar Galactica that Marvel adapted around this time.
Okay.
They would adapt the first episode and then go their own way and do their own thing. Gil Kane's issue is even less complete, being just pencils and scribbled notes as to the order that the panels are going to be in. Kane's is much more linear, with an adaptation of the opening titles and then explaining how he ends up in the village. Kirby starts with him already in the village.
Yeah.
And eschews all of that. Kirby dances around to keep the action flow. Kane does an almost shot-for-shot recreation of the episode, although he still misses details. There's a note about the girl that picks him up and takes him around. It's very cosmopolitan. You never know who you'll meet. There's a note that she's Chinese.
Right.
So he's probably going to have to redraw that page or those bits, should it ever saw print, which it didn't. He draws the village members without the badges. More interesting, if you have a look at the first page of the Kane stuff, going all the way, you can hear the pages turning, which is a great point. He doesn't draw the Lotus.
No.
Ah, but remember that for later. The Kane issue, see, we're so good at this now, aren't we? The Kane issue ends with Dance of the Dead. You can clearly see Dance of the Dead will be the next episode.
Right.
So were they going to just adapt the show?
So they even at this time, they didn't know if it was going to be original or adaption.
The supplementary material shed some light on that.
Right.
So Mike Royer has inked and Mike Allred has coloured the stunning 2-page splash.
It's a great splash.
Yeah, of Kirby having 6 arriving in the village. Again, I don't know if he photo-referenced Port Marion, but it pretty much looks like it, doesn't it? It looks like that's what he's done. The issue also edits an awful lot to fit into 17 pages. I don't know that Kirby would have been happy just adapting other people's episodes every month.
Yeah.
I think he very much would have done his own thing. Kane's splash page was redrawn for Bacon, whatever that is. Bacon. It is now the Lotus.
Right.
However, he's now put him in his blazer,
so is
which he doesn't wear outside of the village.
Has Kane done that, or has the inker redone that?
I don't know who has done that. It doesn't say. Just Kane's splash has been redrawn, but has added an extra mistake. So I don't know. Could have been the inker. Just Steve Lealoa could very well have done that, yeah, because it says that he inked it. So fair enough. There's an essay by Steve Englehart, who obviously would have adapted Gil Kane's version. He says Gene Colan was supposed to be the artist.
Okay.
Turned it down. He also reveals that the next issue would have been The Chimes of Big Ben.
Right.
Which was an episode, but that doesn't match what's on the original art.
So there's three contradictory things.
Yeah.
Unless, I mean, it was penciled in, so it doesn't mean it was necessarily final.
And obviously, it never went to print, so they never even had to make a decision. Then we see Kane's version fully scripted and lettered.
Next to the scripts.
Next to the scripts. You know, and then when that finishes, the chimes of Big Ben, not Dance of the Dead.
Right.
So that's interesting. And then there's a reproduction of the Prisoner ITC press book from 1967 and an article about the show. If you are a fan of the original show, this is the one I would consider the must buy.
Right.
And if you're a Jack Kirby fan,
yeah,
this is a must buy.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in and of itself, it's not a particularly good book. There's nothing in there that's inherently readable. It is just about the art, but the art itself is enough of kind of like a timepiece.
Especially, essentially, it's a full page of a full issue of yeah. Jack Kirby that never saw print.
Did it never see print? Because I was interested in this when I read the introduction to Shadow Visage. So I'm assuming a lot of this is because of McGowan's prickly nature that this didn't surface. And I'm assuming it's not mentioned, but DC got the rights because Marvel's fell through.
Possibly.
Makes some kind of sense, yeah.
Well, that led me down the pathway of Kirby's 70s work, which then led to what next month's episode is going to be.
We're good at this now.
Which is a Jack Kirby retrospective, but not of the stuff you think you would do a Jack Kirby retrospective of. But I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Command D.
We'll leave that till next time so that there's a little bit of a surprise for you. But however,
a little bit of a surprise.
A little bit of a surprise.
Won't be in the title and the pictures when you put them on social media.
You've got to look at advertising, man. You've got to look at promotion.
Or when it goes on this week, Andy and Michael. Yeah,
look at three Kirby classics. I could not mention which three Kirby classics. Yeah. Are they classics? Who could say?
They are classic.
Who knows? But we will close out today with Bill Robinson, who I did a Prisoner podcast with.
Right.
Called The Village People. Right. The Village Idiots, I forget. Nice. Yeah. Where we talked about The Prisoner. We were going to talk about this on an episode of that show.
Right.
Bill didn't have the final issue.
Right.
So it never happened.
Okay.
So it's happened here. But I asked Bill, if you can get a copy of the final issue, do you want to send us your thoughts? And he has.
Right.
Andrew and Michael, six of one, half dozen of the other. Greetings from the peninsula of America, as I call it, Village, Florida. Mind you, about 60 to 70 miles to the northeast of me is a place called the Villages. Mainly retirees go to live there, or at least that's what's told to the masses. Thank you for asking me for my thoughts on The Prisoner, Shattered Visage. My history with this is a long one, as I had collected the first three issues in 1988 to 1989 and then lost track of it. In 89, I joined the Navy and became a number. I enlisted for 6 years, no irony there, and left one village for another. Back to the book, though. So for about 33 years, no, not another pun using six, three times two, I only thought there were three issues to the series. So either the chaos just before my enlistment or absent-mindedness never saw me getting issue D. Maybe my prisoner mind felt that A, B, and C was the natural way to end the story, as that was one of the TV series episodes. Either way, I had forgotten the last issue until Andy brought it up in our coverage of the TV series with our friends Paul and David, both of which had never seen the show, whilst you and I watched it numerous times over the various decades. I had not read this in 30 plus years, so many plot points were washed away. My recollection before reading it was that a woman washed ashore on the island and found number 2 and 6 still fighting control for the village. I remembered they thought and perhaps 2 died and 6 reclaimed his life and she got away. Remember, I was basing those memories off the only 3 issues and a Swiss cheese memory at... Ooh, sorry, wrong show. I was surprised to slowly recall the fact that she was an agent, married, had a child, and all the other government subterfuge that was taking place. I'm not sure what the two of you are going to cover in the show, so I won't spoil anything. I will say that I spotted some Easter eggs along the read, such as Port Muscat and 2 people in the pews during the funeral that have to be the dynamic duo from the Avengers, and I'm not talking Marvel either. Oh, Steed and Mrs. Peel.
Right, okay.
I didn't spot Steed and Mrs. Peel.
That's cool.
That's cool. I have many other things that I spotted, but either you can bring them up or in the future we'll get the band back together to do this series in detail on Back to the Bins. Overall, with my memory of the first three issues restored and the final installment, I can say that I enjoyed this version. Maybe the grand finale of what happens in the village was a bit over the top. I read that, of course, some critics are pro and con, and I can see their points on either side. To me, at least, there has always been ambiguity in The Prisoner, so leaving some questions open and up to the reader or watcher to figure out for themselves is par for the course. Because we don't always have to have questions explained and laid out before us as easily as answered, because questions are a burden to others and answers are a prison to oneself. Be seeing you in all the old familiar places. Cuckoo, cuckoo, Mr. Robinson. P.S. Am I number six? I have a six in my month, a six in my day, and a six in my year of birth. Maybe I'm somebody else. Thank you, Bill, for joining us, at least in spirit, for covering The Prisoner Shattered Visage. I very much enjoyed that. Thank you, Michael Bailey, for at least a decade ago sending me a copy of that. And finally, we got around to covering it. Next time on an all-new episode of Hate Kids Comics. I don't think I've done that for a while.
Have you not?
Never tell. It seems like I did it every week, and then I stopped doing it, and then I did it, and then, well, whatever. We're going to be looking at some Jack Kirby classics from the 70s. Which Jack Kirby classics? Well, you're just going to have to wait and see. Take care.
Be seeing you.
Very good. Goodbye. Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production, and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the sci-fi cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the Pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to him. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/aleyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics coming in your ears. It's a date.